Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Today's episode is sponsored by ByHeart, which is an infant nutrition company built from the ground up to deliver real innovation on behalf of babies and parents. Their mission is simple: make the best formula in the world. In our house, we never skim on family time together on the weekends. Instead of racing around crazy, we prioritize time at home, time to relax, time to do fun, crazy things that we wouldn't have ordinarily. And you know who else doesn't skim? ByHeart. ByHeart is the only American-made infant formula with globally sourced ingredients to use organic, grass-fed whole milk without a drop of skim. Whole milk is full of healthy fats like naturally occurring MFGM, which play an important role in babies' brain development and growth. Are you curious about ByHeart? Redeem your welcome offer at byheart.com/podcast with codename Zibby20 for a limited time.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, the creator and host of the award-winning podcast that you're listening to right now. Thank you so much, called Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. It is a daily podcast, 365 days a year, and each day we talk to an author about all of the things related to their career, their book, their life, and more in 30 minutes or less, because who has time? I am now an author myself, although I wasn't when I started this podcast, and you can get my new memoir, Bookends, a memoir of love, loss, and literature, wherever books are sold starting July 1st, and my children's book, Princess Charming. You can learn more about me at ZibbyOwens.com, but really, you're here to learn more about the authors, and that is what we're going to do. Also, be sure to check out all the other podcasts in the Zcast Podcast Network. You can learn more at zcastnetwork.com and definitely check out those shows as well.
Alice Elliott Dark is the author of Fellowship Point, a novel. She's also the author of Think of England and two collections of short stories, In the Gloaming and Naked to the Waist. Her work has appeared in, among others, The New Yorker, Harper's, Doubletake, Plowshares, A Public Space, Best American Short Stories, Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards, and has been translated into many languages. In the Gloaming, a story, was chosen by John Updike for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories of the Century and was made into films by HBO and Trinity Playhouse. Her nonfiction reviews and essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many anthologies. She is a recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and an associate professor at Rutgers Newark in the English Department and the MFA program. Welcome, Alice. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Fellowship Point.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. I'm happy to have you. Okay. I know I said you don't have to perform, but I would like you to describe Fellowship Point to people who have not read it yet.
Okay. Well, it's a big, long 550-something page book about three women, two women who are 80 and a young woman who's 26, how they interact about various subjects, the main one of which is what's going to happen to a beautiful piece of land in Maine that's owned by the two 80-year-olds. They have shares in a fellowship that was started by one of them, great-great-great-grandfather, in 1875, and they've now it's the year 2000. They're both 80, and one of them, Agnes, is single and has no children, so she can't pass her share to anybody. She's worried about what's going to happen if it goes to the children of her best friend, Polly, who's another shareholder, and her nephew, Archie, because there have been noise around about possibly developing the land, which totally horrifies her. And then another thread of the book is this young 26-year-old assistant editor who works in a publishing company in Manhattan. And she has the bright idea to ask Agnes to write a memoir. Agnes is a very popular children's book author. And she thinks if Agnes writes a memoir about how she came to write the books and what was her inspiration, that it will be really good for selling the books, and it will also be good for getting her ahead in her publishing career. So those are the basic, those are the basics.
I love the scenes that take place in publishing. So the whole thing, and even the aspiring writer, not aspiring writer because she's already an author, but the writer's block of the moments and trying to figure out how to structure what's next. And you weaved in a breast cancer diagnosis or towards the beginning. And you had one line, which I loved, when she had said, you had said, maybe the surgery would slice away her writer's block, as if having some massive surgery would at least yield some ancillary benefit of producing writerly material.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, Agnes is kind of, she's kind of a tough, crusty character who has very high principles, and she does her best to make good decisions in life, but she's also is capable of making remarks that sort of make people recoil because she's so blunt. She's so blunt, which was very fun to write, you know, fun to write a person like that. I'm not like that. I always thought when I got to be an old lady, I could be like that, but I'm not so sure.
I mean, having a filter takes energy. You might as well.
It's true. It takes a lot of energy and practice.
Yes. But Agnes is also, you know, very sympathetic. Her husband goes through a rejection where he does not get promoted. And she says something lovely like, this isn't a nice thing to do to this old man.
That's actually Polly.
I'm sorry. That's Polly.
Polly, the best friend, who is married with three children, has had a fourth child who died as a 9-year-old. But yeah, she's not as harsh as Agnes, and she has more empathetic feelings like that toward a lot of people.
Well, at least you get both sides of the coin here.
Yeah, exactly.
Early on. And we know you as an author then can have both sides represented.
I'm not sure I'm either side, but it was fun to write into those. It was fun to write into those characteristics and just inhabit them for a while.
And why make them 80?
That just happened when the characters came into my imagination. They were 80. And it took a few years for me to wonder, what am I doing? This feels like career suicide to be writing about people who are old, because they're not really traditional heroines. And then I just was so far in at that point, I thought, well, I really actually have a lot to say about old women. I've always loved old women since I was a child. My grandmother used to take me to visit her great aunts, and they lived in what I came to understand was a nursing home, but I thought it was a mansion.
And,
they were sisters. They together. They had candy. They painted plates. When I go over there, I just think they really have the life. This is it. This is it. And ever since then, I was kind of fascinated by older women, because I noticed early that people didn't pay attention to them. So I thought they got to have a lot of freedom and were able to be in the world without having to answer for a lot, you know. And I always gravitate in a party or something to the old woman in the room, because I think there's stuff going on there that no one else is bothering to figure out. but I'm curious.
It's almost like people don't want to acknowledge that soon that will be them. It's like
I think that's a lot of it. And yeah, there's something, I don't know, with biology, you know, that once you're not of child producing age, that you're extraneous to the biological needs of the species, or I don't know what it is, but we all know it. You know, once you get to be a certain age, you start to feel a difference, and then it just keeps going. And it's kind of a fascinating thing. I really felt as I was writing this, and I was inhabiting these women. I started this when I was in my 50s. I'm in my 60s now. They were older than me. And I really felt like we're like wasting a lot of political energy in this country by not having older women be much more of a force than they are. Because the older women I know are very active, they're vital, they keep up with everything. They're just the same but older. You know, they have physical things, but a lot of them don't have any other deficits, and yet they're shunted aside. So I got to be very, sort of politically motivated to make sure that I portrayed them as being highly viable citizens.
Interesting. Yeah, I keep kind of shouting from the rooftops over here about how huge readers older women are and how nobody bothers marketing to them because, you know, everyone in my family, all I do is see older women commenting on Facebook even now and being massive consumers and very engaged with the material. And they do have time to read for the most part and are super smart and engaged and thoughtful. And yet everyone's trying to get, you know, millennials who have like 8,000 things going on and might not, you know, I don't know. I feel people miss the mark sometimes in not doing campaigns. So I don't know. I'm doing some presentations to nursing homes and I'm like, made this like a priority.
That's so terrific because I've really found being out with this book that women, let's say, starting at 55, but especially if they're around 75 to 85 themselves, and even I've gotten letters from people in their 90s, they are so grateful to have a big book where two 80-year-old women are the main characters and they have a lot going on in their lives. And they're just so grateful to see it because that reflects their reality. And they don't really have that reality reflected very much in any forum. And I agree with you about the marketing, because as I've been doing this, I've been thinking there's a huge market that's not being marketed to.
Yep. I know. I shouldn't have revealed the secret of mine.
Well, I guess it's my secret too, because now that I've figured this out, I want to figure out how to get this book into the hands of more people who I know will appreciate it at a level and in a different way than younger readers. I've had lots of younger readers, lots of letters from men, lots of all kinds of people who I didn't know what the market would be for this book. No one ever really knows, but I did find out that it's an identity book for older women, which is really gratifying to me.
Well, you think about how many people talk about how isolating it feels not to be able to connect with someone in fiction, right? There's so much talk about the power of having novels or memoirs to make you feel less alone. But what if you are looking for that and then there's almost nothing to grab onto?
Exactly.
Makes you feel even worse. And so I feel like, you know, production from a range of viewpoints has expanded in some areas, and yet some are still sort of need to be dusted off. So
totally
I love what, in other, all I'm trying to say, I love what you're doing. And I didn't mean to say that this is my idea, not yours.
I totally understand. I do. And you're in a position to really make massive advances in this area. I'm not, but I totally applaud that this is something that you're really thinking about because it's out there.
I mean, my grandmother, until probably, I don't know, 6 months before she passed away at 93,
every time we talked, the first thing we asked was, what are you reading? Mm-hmm. What are you reading? And even my husband's grandmother, she would come here and she's like, oh, look at the books. And she would just sit and read every time she visited the whole time. And all they wanted to do, they just wanted to talk. And I'm not basing this on a sample set of two. This is obviously much bigger, but
it's also a fact that the people who are now between 75 and 95, let's say, they grew up in a reading era too.
Yes. Yes.
When it was, you know, when you would go to a dinner party and it would be, let's talk about this book.
Yes.
Instead of let's talk about this TV show or this movie or this politician. It was like everybody had read the books.
Yes.
You know, so it was a common conversation. I remember that so well when I was growing up, because I was lucky enough to grow up around a reading family. But that doesn't happen anymore. You know, you don't go to a dinner party and everybody's just read the same book.
Maybe a very literary dinner party.
Maybe a very literary dinner party, but not just, you know, a suburban dinner party.
True.
It's different now, but then it really was like that.
Well, not just the same book, but there were only like a couple TV shows. I mean, I feel like that's something that we've all lost.
Yeah.
There's so much choice that we don't bond about the same things at all.
I know. It's
shows,
really
movies, books. I mean, it's nice that everybody gets to customize, but it's also really not nice.
Yeah. I wonder about that too. I mean, I do feel something's lost by having every taste catered to it at every moment, you know, and not having some common, I don't know. I mean, it's a big subject.
Yeah, we don't have to tackle that. I am curious though, in your touring and publicity and getting to know your reader audience, what has been most successful in terms of reaching those readers? Like, what have you done? How do you think? I mean, obviously, you have such a giant platform because you're so amazing. But like, what have you done to ferret out the readers who need this the most?
Well, I'm still working on that because I think that I really didn't think of who was going to be the reader for the book. It just seemed like, you know, a big story and characters to me. But now I'm trying to think about how to reach older readers and go into, like you said, retirement places where there are book groups and book clubs. And I mean, I have ideas about it too. Maybe we should talk.
Yeah, we should talk offline about it. We'll talk offline. I know I'm doing like a class in this elderly, like continuing education thing. And I'm going up to a nursing home in Massachusetts. And anyway, I don't know. Okay. We'll get back to that. Let's talk about, tell me about how you go about structuring a book where you know there's so much going on over the course of so much, and that you're going to have this, you might want like a saga, right? Like a 500 juicy pages of information and twists and turns. Do you know that at the outset? And how do you have to structure it? Do you have all your plans laid out, or do you just start with a little idea and you're like, I'll give this as many pages as it needs to get where I went. And then I know when I've reached it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
B. I didn't know at the outset. The characters came to me one by one. I knew when I got the first character, which was Virgil, who doesn't have a big part in the book, but he was the first character who came to me. And when he came to me, he came in such a way that I knew, oh, I'm in a novel. You know, it just felt like it had a different quality to it. It was, I think it's the first time I've ever really written purely from imagination, except for the settings, Philadelphia and Maine, real places, not Fellowship Point, but Maine. But the characters were all made up before. I've always taken a little bit from here and there from people I know. And this time they just appeared whole as themselves. And I started putting them together and having them talk to each other and watching what they said to each other and thinking about their interactions. And that taught me who they were. I always like to test out characters by putting them in kind of extreme situations, like, and then what do they do? Like get lost in the wilderness or something, you know, and just see like how they behave. It's a good little exercise. But then a couple of things led to the structure of the book, which was, one was I saw a mini series based on a Trollope novel. And I thought, oh my God, I really love these big plots with twists, turns, subplots, all of it. I want to try and learn how to write one. So that came. And then the other thing that happened was visited my friend Tina in California, and she was very involved in land trusts and with University of California cataloging all their land. And she told me that so many of the donors were women, who had donated their ranch that they had inherited, thousands of acres kind of ranches. And I started researching women land donors and women founders of national parks and all of this. It was really fascinating subject, not really a well-known history in this country of that kind of conservation and donation by women. And I started having a thought that women have not been able to control the land that they owned for very long. 1900 was the first date that women in all 50 states, well, the states that existed in 1900, were allowed to control land. Otherwise, it was brother, husband, father, uncle, cousin, you know, any man could have control over it before the woman could. So then I just thought, women have a different feeling about landowning than men do, because it's not part of our DNA. It really isn't. You know, we've lived on the borrowed land and sort of the goodwill of others for a long time. And it sort of has made it possible, I think, for a lot of women to not hold that as an identity. You know, they pass through the land, they love the land, and they love the land so much that they don't want it developed. They prefer to give it to a trust or a park or something. So once I had all those elements together, I had the idea. How I structured it after that was trial and error. You know, lots of pages, lots of throwing away.
Wow. And how long did it take for the whole book to be written?
I started in 2011 and I turned it in to my agent in 2018. Then I did a couple of drafts with my editor, Mary Sue Rucci, and she was at Simon & Schuster, and then she moved to Scribner and took me with her over to Scribner. And then I think I wrote the end of the book when it was already typeset. I just was not happy with how it ended. So I came up with a new ending. So I would say the whole thing was done by 2020.
Wow.
9 years. 9 years, but not 9 full years, because I don't work during my teaching semesters. Not on something big like this. It's too big. I couldn't keep it in my head and keep all my student work and everything in my head at the same time.
And tell me more about your teaching.
I teach at Rutgers Newark in the MFA program and in the English department. And the semester's in full swing right now.
Oh my gosh. Thanks for even taking the time.
No, it's wonderful.
It's good too, because now you have like a built-in audience, right? Hands-on marketers, you know?
Well, I'm not so sure they would be very, you know.
Oh.
For lots of reasons. So I'm not, you know, I've mentioned my grad students are interested because they are working to become writers themselves. My undergrads, I've mentioned as I'm teaching lit, well, I'm a writer too, and I kind of understand. And they're like, okay. Okay, teach, move on.
Oh my goodness. So funny. Can you talk more about how you got to this place in your life, how you became a teacher and a writer, and if you knew from when you were a child, if this is the path you were going on, or how you got here?
I was a child writer. I think I started at about 7 and kept going. And then when I got through school, I stopped during the college years. I just got to a place where I felt people like me didn't become real writers. You know, it was wonderful at school, and I went to a school that had a lot of literary stuff going on. But I just didn't live in a culture where people became, they were more very sophisticated consumers of literature, music, art, but not creators. So it took me a little while to get back to it. And it really happened after college, when I just found that there was nothing I wanted. I mean, there were a lot of things I wanted to do, but I was too shy to go try and do them. I was really desperately shy. So I took up writing again, and I wrote poetry until I was about 30. And then I started writing prose and just kept going from there, started teaching, started working at Rutgers in 2000. And yeah, now it's a good balance because I have one son. He's also trying to be a writer, or he is a writer. He just wrote a big novel. And once he left in 2010, I all of a sudden could manage everything. Before that, I always feel like you can do 3 things, not 4 things. You know, something, you know, a child, job, writing, you know, and then house, friends, blah, blah, blah. Put all that in. I mean, you could parse it out to 8 things, but I think you can do 3 things with full heart. And after that, you're doing things a little bit less. So after he left, and, you know, kids take even more than a third.
Yes.
They're like in your head. So once he moved out, that's when things started getting a little more organized for me. And it's no surprise that I started this book in 2011, because I just had the headspace that I hadn't had since he was born to write a big book.
Yeah. I say that it wasn't until I got divorced and had every other weekend without my kids that I even again. That's like,
that's how I wrote your book.
That's how I've done basically everything.
I totally get it.
Yeah, there's no way I could have. I mean, even still, I can barely, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, these kids, look at them. Just because when, and also that you have to drop, like, I will drop anything anytime if someone has an issue, right? And then, of course,
you still do.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, like, so.
I think that's forever too.
So what's next for you? You have this big book out. Congratulations. Amazing. You're teaching. Like, what next?
I'm writing another book. And after that, I probably will write another. You know, at this stage, I really want to just be writing full time. I'm not quite finished with teaching. There's still things I want to do in that part of my career because, yeah, they're just things left. But I'm looking forward to being a full-time writer. And when I am, I'm going to go at it pretty hard until I just feel like, okay, enough. And then I'll just enjoy looking at the ocean or something. I don't know. That's how I picture my future.
This is totally inappropriate. You don't have to answer this. I'm always really interested with people who have let their hair go gray or white or whatever. You don't have to talk about it. And I could cut this question, but I'm curious.
I'm happy to talk about it. So I had very dark hair that people called black hair. It was very dark. And I started getting white hair, I guess, in my 30s. And then I started, I guess when I was about 40, I started doing suburban blonde because I had enough, you know, I had enough gray hair by that point. It wasn't really black anymore. It was turning gray. And then at a certain point, I guess something happened that I didn't color it fast enough. And I noticed that it was actually white underneath, not gray anymore. And I thought, okay, well, that I like that. You know, I can live with that. But it is funny. You know, women love it. And men tell, you know, my friends will say that their husband said, don't you dare do that. It's really, there's a big gender divide about the white hair thing.
Interesting. I think it looks gorgeous.
Thank you.
I did read an article. I was debating if I should just let myself go gray, which is sort of selfishly motivated question. And I did, there was a whole thing in the Times about how women think it's cool and men are just like, they don't want their wives necessarily to be
exactly.
All gray.
Exactly. Yeah. I've run into that so much and I don't really understand. I mean, I guess it makes them think they'll look older if they look like, if they're with a woman who is not afraid to identify as being an older woman. I mean, I think that's their perspective. It's not women's perspective at all. I mean, women, you know, women have very different ideas about how they feel good about themselves, you know, and I just knew I would feel good not doing all that coloring anymore. It's so boring.
So boring. You know, yeah.
Expensive if you go to a place, which I did sometimes. Sometimes I did it myself. All of that, I just was like, oh, if I could just get rid of that part of my life, I'd be so happy. But it is complicated. It's complicated. I've never looked back. I'm happy with it. But I do notice that people immediately think of me as older. And then they'll say, your face doesn't look old. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't know exactly what you're saying. Okay. I don't think I look 25 either, even if my hair is still blonde, you know. I think it depends a lot on what the color is. Like if you were to do it and you find you have like a gorgeous gray, it makes a lot of difference. And if the texture is nice and all of that.
Yeah. My mom has a friend with this like amazing bob, like beautiful grays and whites. And I was like, but how would I know? Maybe I have that. Maybe
know,
it would look like
might.
That, but I would never know. Probably
you
not.
Might. I mean, it definitely saw a lot of people in the pandemic let it happen.
Yeah.
And so many people I thought looked so much better with the gray hair because it kind of matches your skin tone. You change when you get older, you know, and your skin tone looks great. And then they went back and, you know, I was a little bit sad.
Yeah. I'm more gray, I think, than my mom at this point. So anyway.
Really? Yeah. My mother is gray and she envies this hair. She keeps trying to like put platinum coloring in her hair and it doesn't turn this color. This is not a color you can get out of a bottle. It just, it's like an absence of something that
it's
you
very
can't,
cool. It's
you
very,
can't
very
recreate.
Cool. Well, I love
thank
it.
Thank you.
And sorry
thank
for
you.
Talking about that.
No, it's, you know, what else is, I'm always happy to talk. I could have talked the whole time about
it. My kids actually have a whole section in school this year about hair and how it's so central to identity and it's allowing them to teach about all these different things. And I'm like,
oh, that's great. That's so smart. It's so true.
It's so true. I should offer you up as a speaker for second grade.
I'd love to come in. Pull my hair.
Yeah.
It's real. It's real.
Awesome. All right. Well, Alice, thank you so much for the fun chat and congratulations on your book. And let's stay in touch and start our own, you know?
Yes.
Really interesting marketing approach.
Be happy to.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Zibby. Honor to meet you. Honestly, big things you're doing have been so exciting to all women in the publishing world.
Oh, thank you.
trying, trying hard, doing more than four things. And I was like, oh, no, she's talking to me.
I think you're doing like 20 things. But
anyway, all right. Well, I'm honored to talk to you as well. So thank you. Okay. All right. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.